Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, August 14th, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News, a weekly media critique from the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Mike McKean, director of the RJI Futures Lab, and here at the table with me are Views regulars Amy Simons and Ernest Perry. Amy and Ernest are faculty colleagues at the Missouri School of Journalism. Our topics this week: a clown in an Obama mask puts Missouri in a terrible light, but are journalists playing a bit loose with some of the details? NPR's own ombudsman slams the network for inaccuracies in a 2011 investigation into foster care abuse in South Dakota. A new survey raises the predictable back-to-school argument over whether a journalist needs a journalism degree. NBC's chief political correspondent laments the impact that the Hillary Clinton miniseries will have on his newsroom, and stay with us for a special announcement at the end of the show. But first, the Missouri story heard round the world this week. It involves, as you've already guessed, that rodeo clown and rodeo announcer performing Saturday night at the state fair in Sedalia. There were no reporters present, so the videos and initial comments about the clown in the Obama mask came from folks on social media. Here's a YouTube clip that appears to show how the whole thing started.
Did they tell you about our famous helper we're going to have out here tonight?
No, they did not.
You ain't saying anything about it?
Who is it?
It's Obama!
Hey, let me tell these people about who we got helping. Obama's going to have to just stay there. Obama, watch out for those bulls.
The announcer is Boonville School Superintendent Mark Ficken. The clown with the microphone is Tuffy Gessling.
Tuffy Gessling, ladies and gentlemen.
And don't forget Obama!
And President Obama.
Hey, I know I'm a clown. He's just running around acting like one, doesn't know he is one.
In another clip, you hear the clown saying, quote, "We're going to smoke Obama, man." And, quote, "As soon as this bull comes out, Obama, don't you move. He's going to get you. The Missouri State Fair Board has banned that clown from ever appearing there again. Appearing Monday on KBIA's Intersection program, Fair Director Mark Wolf apologized and called the routine, quote, "an unconscionable stunt by one individual." But attention also fell on the announcer. Mark Ficken had just been elected president of the Missouri Rodeo Cowboy Association. He defended himself in this interview with the Missouri Net's Bob Pretty.
I feel like I'm being witch hunted when I'm an announcer. I'm not the one who was doing the things in the arena with the dummy. I have nothing to do with that. I'm a person who announces the name, the stock, the scores, and the times. And at no point did I do anything disrespectful to the President of the United States. I'm a very proud person of the United States.
Now, you can watch the clips on our links blog in full and decide for yourself whether Ficken was disrespectful to the president. Regardless, the heat is on him for sure. He resigned from the Cowboy Association yesterday, and the Boonville School District, his full-time employer, announced that it was investigating whether the superintendent was involved in, quote, "inappropriate conduct." If you listen closely to the Missouri Net interview, you'll also hear Ficken talk about, quote, "the dummy." We'll talk about the significance of that reference in just a bit. But let's start now with thoughts about how this story has developed and how people have reacted to the media coverage. I mean, Amy, this story is global. Al Jazeera is running
it. Al Jazeera is running it. I mean, I first found out about it on social media Sunday night, started reading and watching some of the YouTube clips, and wondered how far it was going to blow up. I knew when I turned on the Today Show, and it was the first mention in the lead of the Today Show Monday morning. When we've started talking about becoming a post-racial society here in the United States, and then this happens, it's going to blow up. This is every news agency's opportunity to point and say, maybe not.
I mean, and Ernest, it clearly was a story once this became public. The question is the media coverage of it appropriate or is it overkill?
Well, I would say that it's overkill. It's August. It's usually a slow news month. If this had happened, say, with President Bush or President Clinton back during their time in the White House, I'm not sure whether or not it would have gotten the same play. But being that everything that centers around President Obama has something to do with race, him being the first black president, when something like this happens, as Amy said, when we talk about being in a post-racial society and then something like this occurs, that's sort of a contradiction that the media automatically jumps on to say, well, wait a minute, maybe we're stepping a little bit too far out when we talk about post-racial society.
When you look at comments from readers and viewers who'd seen this story, they were pretty predictable. I mean, either in some people's opinion, they were proof that Missourians are racist or from other side of the coin, politically correct and posturing when presidents, as you said, have been subject to parody for a long time. So, you know, when you look at reaction from officialdom, it was a little bit more on all of it came from the same direction, basically. Whether you were Republican, Democrat, you were denouncing it, saying that it was at the very least, not being respectful of the office of the presidency. And you saw the reaction also. They fired the clown. They told the clown, don't you ever come back. The superintendents being investigated. Are all of those reactions normal or are they overkill in some ways?
I think those reactions are overkill. But this is what's happening, not just in this instance, but you can go back to what happened with Paula Deen. You can go all the way back to what happened with the agriculture department worker who was let go and then brought back. In today's heightened partisan political atmosphere, when something like this happens, there tends to be an overreaction on the part of politicians, on the part of government administrators. Here you've got a private organization that's involved in a state fair. They're overreacting. So I think what you see, and even the media itself is overreacting. So what you see here is just overreaction on the part of a lot of people to a highly charged, highly partisan situation.
Well, at the same time, though, I would also say the state fair does receive $400,000 per year in state taxpayer money. And even with some overreaction in dealing with the situation in the immediate aftermath, there is still that question to be looked at in terms of what messages are being sent and what is going on when taxpayer money is going toward the event where something like this is happening.
And looking at sort of the traditional media's responsibility here, Amy, I mean, first of all, as we said before, there weren't any, to our knowledge, any reporters in the crowd at the rodeo. So what we got were YouTube videos, photos, pasted, put on Facebook, and various comments from social media. And there's not any one sort of shot which shows you the entire visual account of what happened. So are you concerned at all that journalists, traditional journalists, were taking their cues from an incomplete record of the event?
Yeah, that's absolutely an issue. And if you look at those YouTube videos that were first surfacing on YouTube, on Facebook, that user-generated content, that's not the greatest quality of video. So you're also trying to determine what each person is saying is happening in those images. And Fricken is saying that the clown also had a microphone, that he was making some of those comments. You can't actually see that in the video to be able to determine that for sure and to be able to know that. And without having a clear understanding and personal knowledge of what each person's voice sounds like, too, there's no way to verify.
One of the other issues, and this goes back to not just this story, but a lot of these stories, is that context is missing. And that's one of the things that when things sort of blow up on social media, everyone's running to get the story as quickly as possible and try to get out front. But the actual context of what happened, in other words, to just step back and say, let's look at this in its totality and then report that, comes up missing. Because one of the things I haven't seen is comments from actual people who are in the stands who heard this. Right. And that, to me, that's one of the ways in which you can get that context. But if you aren't trying to seek those people out to get that, then part of the story is lost.
The other part of it, too, is that the internet and social media, they're amplifiers.
Right.
So as soon as this gets out there once, it's going to blow up and out of control before there's the time for people to do the due diligence in determining those facts and talking to the people who were there.
And I think a potential example of that – now, again, I wasn't there. I'm only going on what I could see and read after the fact.
And but, I don't think – none of us were there. None of us were there.
But – one of the, you know, the more disturbing themes was the fact that it wasn't just this, you know, cowboy who's a, or I mean this clown, and it's his job to entertain, doing, saying something silly, but the audience reaction to it. And all of the stories suggested that the crowd in the fairground stands were applauding and cheering as the president was being denigrated by this clown. Now, when I was watching the video clips, you heard some applause or laughter. It wasn't clear to me that the entire audience was behind it. We don't know because we weren't there and we haven't gotten eyewitness accounts, or at least I haven't seen any.
Nor do we have the context of the size of the audience. There could have been seven people.
Exactly.
It could have been 700. It could have been seven.
Now, yeah, I mean, you are talking about it was on probably one of the largest nights of the fair, but you don't know whether people were just walking around. They may have been looking at something else. You just don't have enough information to determine that the majority of the crowd was sort of embracing what was going on out in the arena.
I mean, I don't doubt that some people did. Now, Missouri Net's Bob Priddy, who's a national leader in broadcast news for many years and a graduate of our school, wrote a blog post this week in which he challenges some of the assumptions that the journalists appear to be making in reporting the story. When you examine the videos and the still pictures from social media very closely, for example, I think he makes a pretty good case that the clown in the Obama mask is in fact a dummy, a prop, as referenced in the interview by Ficken. And whether it's a dummy or a very wooden human being, the person with the mask doesn't appear to have a microphone. So I guess my question, first of all, Amy, is do these details matter for reporters in the sort of larger narrative that journalists are spinning out of this?
The details absolutely do, because that's where you're going to find the truth of what really went on there. And you need to talk to the organizers of the rodeo. Who had microphones? Who had the ability to project their voice to the crowd? Who could have been responsible for saying what was said? Who was wearing a mask? Who wasn't?
I think the other thing, too, is that was this a planned part of the show? Because if it was, then why didn't someone step in and say, well, wait a minute, we may be doing something here that may get us into some hot water at some point? Because, you know, you're talking about the clowns get together, they talk about what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. It's a show, and most shows are planned.
Now, Fricken claims that he did not know about this, that it wasn't planned. But again, without knowing the
because
clowns
and
what
they're...
Because
he was an announcer hired by one organization and the clowns were contract artists working for another company. So that could be. Now, Priddy and a few other columnists I've read see this story as not just an example of questionable behavior on the part of journalists, but also a cautionary tale about how carefully journalists should view and vet material from the internet that they haven't personally witnessed. We talked about that a little bit. Is that a lesson we should be – should we use this as an object lesson as classes start up with our own journalism students?
The reason that we should use it is because it's the most recent one that will be in recent memory. We have this come up with almost every single big story that involves user-generated content. And in vetting the veracity of material that we don't have control over how it was collected or how it was produced.
And the other thing that we teach in our classes that I think this story really points out is, does this story fit into a common stereotypical narrative? And it does. But the actual facts of the story may not be a part of that. But if you can take the race element, if you can take the highly charged political atmosphere, if you can take the overreach of journalists and others and how they react to it, it all fits into a narrative that works into a package that a journalist can easily put out there. Yeah. But the facts themselves don't necessarily support that.
Well, while we're talking about the behavior and standards of journalists, we might as well tackle the question that seems to pop up every year about this time as school's getting ready to start, and that's, do journalists really need a journalism degree? There was renewed debate about this last week at the annual Journalism Educators Conference in Washington, and it stemmed from a survey of teachers and professional journalists that was conducted by the Poynter Institute. Now, the author of the study, he argues that there's a growing gap between the expectations of those two groups. I'm not so sure about that. I mean, it does show, surprise, surprise, that teachers are much more likely to think that a journalism degree is important for understanding the values of journalism, and they're slightly more likely than media employees to say that a degree is important in getting a job. Now, I don't know whether that gap is widening. Poynter doesn't offer any comparative data from past surveys, but I always kind of come back to the issue of attitudes versus actions. I mean, it seems to me, Amy, that many news organizations still want to see that stamp when they're interviewing job candidates.
And it's part of the boilerplate job posting that we receive from recruiters and from professionals in newsrooms all the time, that there's an interest in a requirement of a degree in journalism, communication, or related field. And that or related field opens things up a little bit. But that does seem to be the standard bearer.
I did find it, you know, Ernest, somewhat interesting that 4 in 10 of the educators that were surveyed and nearly half of the media professionals say they don't think that J schools are keeping up with industry changes. Do you agree with that?
I think that there are some schools that are keeping up and there are others that aren't. And a lot of it goes back to, do you actually have the finances? Do you have the resources to be able to do that? But then again, one of the things that we're finding out is that when our graduates leave and go into the industry itself is not keeping up with the technology. They were working on better equipment and learning much more up-to-date ways in which to communicate with audiences in school than is actually being practiced in the profession. So when I see that, when I see that come up in the survey, I sort of question it a bit.
And I've spoken with recent grads who are settling into their new jobs and professional roles, and they'll tell me, you know, I'm working with antiquated versions of different editing software, different programs that I've had to make a case with my employers why they should upgrade to what it is that we used when I was or when they were in class here at the School of Journalism.
And I also think that, you know, our students students across the country in various journalism programs are coming out with new ways of thinking about social media and reaching audiences that the traditional media or the legacy media is still trying to catch up with. So, like I said, you know, I just find some of the findings in this study to be quite dubious.
I also think it's kind of like the surveys when you ask, do you trust Congress? No. Mm-hmm. Do you trust your member of Congress? Yes. Do you trust the media? No. Do you trust your local newspaper? Yes. Do you trust journalism schools to train these people properly? No. Do you trust the journalism schools you go to all the time to hire people? Yes. So, you know, again, there's only so far you can go with a survey like that. I wonder about the notion, though, that the folks from Poynter were raising as well, and that whether or not there's a distinction between journalism training and its importance in today's world and a journalism degree from a traditional institution. I mean, all higher education is dealing with this question now. You know, online courses, are they good enough for people who are wanting to, you know, get jobs when the cost of higher education at a bricks and mortars kind of institution like ours is so high? And what do you think?
I have mixed feelings about this, and I can go back and forth on any given day. Let's take the example we were just talking about with should we be bringing the rodeo clown incident into our classes as examples. The idea of a massively open online class is a great idea. It gives people instruction. It gives people an overview of something where they can learn some material. What they're not learning how to do in that type of an environment is think critically and apply those situations in real life. And when we can bring an example like that into the classroom and we can be in a discussion section with a student and talk about how these real world experiences, these real world incidents happen and the thought process in terms of the ethics and what needs to happen, what you need to do, and encourage the students to think about it critically and guide their thought process, that's where the real learning and value comes in the classroom setting.
I think one of the other issues here is that when you look at business, when you look at engineering and medicine and programs like that, there's quite a bit of investment on the part of the profession and the industry itself back into education. That doesn't happen it happens in journalism, but not as often as it does in those other fields. And I think that if we really want to deal with this, does a journalism education really matter? I think one of the answers to that is it should matter to the profession, and the profession should be working with journalism education to invest in that.
We're going to have a very hard time, I'm afraid, doing justice to our next topic, but we're at least going to skim it. So if you're really interested in the subject, read all the details on our blog. But last week, NPR's ombudsman, that's the person paid by the network to represent the public and hold NPR accountable, issued a scathing report about an investigative series that aired almost 2 years ago. In that series, NPR essentially alleged that the state of South Dakota was systematically taking Native American children from their homes and giving them to white foster families, at least in part, to gain federal reimbursement dollars. The series won a prestigious Peabody Award, but in his 80-page report, Edward Schumacher-Matos concludes that the network didn't prove its contentions, wrote in a tone that was unfair to the state, didn't offer an adequate response from state officials, included important factual errors, and did some incomplete reporting. Now, NPR published the ombudsman's report, good for them, on its website, but the reporters and the top officials at the network refused to answer his critique in any detail. They basically said, yes, there were a few things we could have done better, but we stand by the stories and we disagree with his conclusions. This is pretty extraordinary, if you ask me, Amy, in several ways. I mean, one, the detail of the critique, because Schumacher-Matos essentially reported the whole thing over again. It was 80 mm-hmm. pages long. Then you've got the vehemence of the denials from NPR's officials. You've got the fact that it's a pretty damning indictment of sloppy reporting, maybe even biased reporting. And then, of course, you've got the fact that how many news organizations even pay somebody to hold their feet to the fire like this?
I think one of the things that's even more alarming, I mean, you just laid out a whole bunch of it right there. Add on top of that, too, NPR's had some issues with accuracy over the course of the past year. They've had full retractions of an entire episode of This American Life. It kind of calls into question what's going on there. And you can either choose to respect or not respect the newsrooms and the news divisions' decision to stand by the story and not go back and do a point by point to refute it. But you do at least have to consider that maybe the ombudsman has a point and to look at what could be going on in the bigger picture there.
I wonder, Ernest, if at least NPR, since they did publish the entire report, good for them, why not then provide a more detailed response rather than just saying we stand by our story?
Well, I think they attempted to do that yesterday on All Things Considered when they actually aired a pretty long piece explaining both the report and the NPR executives' unwillingness, I guess you would say, to ratify the report or to say, yes, you're right or yes, you're wrong. But one of the things that really strikes me in all of this is that in the investigation by the ombudsman, the state actually worked with him. Whereas when NPR was doing the original reporting, the state refused to work with the original reporters, and even in follow-ups, they refused to work with the reporters. So that's an issue right there that I think sort of leads to this sort of disconnect between what the ombudsman is saying and what the NPR news executives are saying.
I do tend to think that the ombudsman had some relevant critiques of their story. And one thing, and I'm not trying to justify their reporting of NPR in any way. If they made those mistakes, they made those mistakes. But it does say something about the need to have more people whose professional job it is to hold media to account. I mean, you can't just count on people through social media or whatever to do that. This paid ombudsman is unfortunately, it's an idea that there aren't very many publications or news organizations that are now following, and I wish more of them would. Well, last week we talked about the news that the Washington Post, one of the last family-owned major papers, was being sold to Amazon.com CEO Jeff Bezos, and plenty has been written about that since then, including some stories asking the question, is the New York Times next? Now, the paper says, no, it's not. What do you think, Amy?
Quite emphatically, the Sulzberger family says, no, it's not. The thing that you need to think about or look at that you would almost have to wonder is just how heavily the family is leveraged, and the fact that the New York Times Company did sell off the Boston Globe last week as well, and the number of assets that remain are very few. So is the family says, no, it's not for sale, that does kind of sit in the back of my mind that is one of the last remaining assets, is there is debt that's being carried, that there are some underfunded pensions there. But it is also one of the few papers that is kind of eking out a bit of a profit at the moment. So,
well, I'm one of those people that say never, because as soon as you say that, it happens. So I think that there's a possibility that could happen, but I don't see that in the near future, mainly because I think the New York Times is trying to position itself to be the national newspaper of record, and getting rid of some of those properties that were basically causing it not to have as much profit as they would like is one of the ways in which they're trying to do that. So I think they're trying to center on the main product, which is the New York Times, and build it to be a larger national platform.
And I still think anytime we're talking about the New York Times, don't hold them up as an example for the rest of the industry, because they are so unique in their situation, what they cover, how they cover, the resources they have to do it. We probably should be careful about that. Well, we also mentioned briefly briefly last week the controversy over a miniseries to be aired by NBC and a documentary to be aired by CNN about Hillary Clinton. As you know, the Republican National Committee chairman threatened to keep 2016 GOP presidential candidates off debates that were sponsored by those two networks if they went ahead with the projects. Well, after our show aired, it was clear that NBC News, at least, was feeling the heat. Political director Chuck Todd, speaking on MSNBC's Morning Joe, said the miniseries would be a total nightmare for the news division.
We know we have nothing to do with it. We know that we'd love probably to be as critical or whatever it is going to be if it comes out, but there's nothing we can do about it, and we're going to only own the negative, whether it's negative because, you know, the Clinton people are upset that it's too tough on them, or negative because the Republicans think it's this glorification of her. No matter what, only we are going to own it because people are going to see the Peacock, and they see NBC, and they see NBC News, and they think, well, they can't be that separate.
Ernest, is he right?
Well, in today's age, I think he has a point, because you've seen over the course of, I would say, the last 20 years, this blurring of news and entertainment. And when you have networks such as NBC News that are connected to MSNBC, which is political, connected to the entertainment wing, which is NBC, the Peacock, as he said, you're going to have this. And when you bring up something like Hillary Clinton, be it as a news or be it as entertainment, the two mesh. So he's right. You're going to have some issues there.
And we've started to see it. It isn't just Chuck Todd. Andrea Mitchell came out and said something. It's starting to spread, in that momentum of discontent within the news division about this project going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you also raised a point that there's a little bit of a complicating factor for NBC, because the NBC news division wants to see itself, and the broadcast network wants to see itself as being very, you know, down the middle with its news coverage. But here he is appearing on MSNBC, which doesn't make any bones at all about its liberal viewpoint. So how can you have it both ways?
You can't have it both ways, because that ship has sailed.
Yeah.
And you've got this merging in the minds and the perception of the public. And what I think is probably going to happen is that if the entertainment backs off, it's going to go to HBO or Showtime or something like that.
Well, finally, I'd like to close the program with an announcement. As you know, Amy and Ernest joined the Views team this summer when Charles Davis and Lee Wilkins took jobs at other universities. And what some in the MU community at least also know is that Charles was one of the five faculty leaders of a program called Mizzou Advantage. For those of you unfamiliar with it, it brings together scholars, business leaders, politicians, the public, to explore four key areas of strength in the university: food, healthcare, sustainable energy, and journalism. Well, a few weeks ago, Provost Brian Foster named me to replace Charles as the Media of the Future facilitator. So that appointment, of course, is an honor and a challenge that I look forward to. But it also means I have to cut back somewhere, as I still retain my roles as director of the Futures Lab at RJI and a teacher like Amy in the Convergence Journalism Program. It takes an entire day each week just to research, produce, and host Views of the News. So as of next week, I'm turning over those duties to Amy. I'm not leaving Views. It's a program that I've hosted for 5 years and participated in for nearly 20. I'm just moving to the other side of the table with Ernest. And that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to Amy and Ernest, as always. Also to our director, Travis McMillan, and audio engineer, Pat Akers. And thanks to you for watching and listening. You can visit our links blog under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org for background articles, audio, and video related to our topics. And you can send us questions, comments, or story suggestions via email to views@kbia.org. I'm Mike McKean. Join us again next week when Amy assumes control for our next and all subsequent editions of KBIA's Views of the News.